Hello and welcome to the Euractiv Agri-Food Podcast. I'm Natasha Foote.
And I'm Gerardo Fortuna.
And here's your weekly update on all things agriculture and food in the EU from Euractiv's Agri-Food News team. So Gerardo, this is our last podcast before the
last
summer break.
Last podcast.
I know, how you feeling?
You need to keep the cliffhanger. So,
oh right, so you say,
you shouldn't mention that there could be a new season of the podcast. It's the last podcast, you know.
Interesting. It's quite clickbaity. But okay. So it's the last podcast before the summer break. How's that? Is that better?
Yeah. And we're not sure about, you know, if there will be something after, beyond the summer break. So let's put it like this.
What?
In general, not only for the agri-food podcast.
Yeah. This is the first time. Not only for the podcast, what, just the whole hub's going to fold after summer. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, probably. No, I mean, not probably. Could be. You'll never know.
Okay, well, this is news to me and to you, the listeners. Anyway. Well, I was
don't
thinking,
take things for granted. This is our message to our listeners.
It's true. In this wild year, you can't take anything for granted, can you? That's just why you got to listen to the podcast every week and make the most of it.
You should have listened to, because, I mean, we don't know if there would be... No,
you
I'm
still
joking.
Can listen. You can go back and listen to all the archives and have relive all the fun all over again.
How many? 41 episodes? No, 40.
You know, I've lost track. I'm not sure.
Because the first season was 27, if I remember correctly.
How do you remember that? Okay, yeah.
But because we started in March, so the second season was a bit longer.
It seems that I have a figure here for the total number of podcasts we've published. Do you want to guess?
I have a figure. You're just looking at the website.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm doing. But you don't have it in front of you, do you?
No.
All right. So what do you think it is?
I came here naked today, so naked in
gosh,
the
gosh, that's a bit too much information, to be honest, Gerardo.
In the sense of
I would just recommend that you stop doing
it. Yeah.
Okay. Let's go back to the numbers. How many do you think we've published?
41. No, 40. This is the first.
Total. Not this season.
57.
It's not bad. It's not a bad guess. It's actually 68.
68? Whoa, that's a lot.
Whoa.
That's a
lot. I know. Imagine the day that we break our 100th episode. 100th. 100th. How do you say that? It's going to be very exciting. And so we thought, in this spirit of, you know, being the last podcast before summer, potentially ever, if you're asking Gerardo, that we would have a little reflection over the last year. Or at least this over this season. When did we start this season? Last September.
September.
And everything that's happened, the school year.
The school year.
Exactly. And there, it was a pretty big year. I mean, there was a lot going on this year, but I guess obviously, you know, it goes without saying that one of the biggest things this year was all to do with the cap, the resolution of the cap, sealing of a deal. Finally, on the EU's farming subsidy program, the Common Agricultural Policy. And, you know, I think as we were approaching this and we knew it was coming, we had the hashtag, we had the final cap down hashtag, and we were covering it all the time. And I was a bit worried that, well, not worried exactly, but, you know, that it was going to be almost a bit sad when the deal was sealed. But never fear, because I've realized very much the fun is not over. And I think something we've seen this year with the cap is that the cap has become cool this year, Gerardo. Wouldn't you agree?
I don't know if you remember when we wrote our look ahead, which is something that we normally write at the beginning of the year at Euractiv. And we mention, we actually use the song of Al Stewart as a reference, the year of the cat, and it becomes the year of the cap. And we already realized that. So basically that would have been finally cool again.
Again? Was it
again,
ever cool?
Yeah.
It's definitely cool now.
No, but I mean, it was actually quite cool or mainstream at the during the plenary vote when the European Parliament back in October, voted on the mandate. And I remember a lot of even coverage on mainstream media outlet, not only it's from us who are more specialized in agriculture. So
we were there before it was cool. I would just like to point out.
Yeah.
You know,
that's true. That's true. That's a good shout.
Slash, did we make it cool? I don't know. I'm just going to leave that question hanging.
I think we gave our contribution. No, I'm joking.
Well, it's definitely, either way, it's definitely firmly in the public consciousness now, which I think means that negotiators and everything that happens on the cap, there's a different pressure. There's a different approach, I think, now, different considerations that need to be taken into account. We've even got, you know, the likes of Greta Thunberg and, you know, we have the whole withdraw the cap movement and everything. It's definitely...
In the sense that, I mean, she doesn't like cap that much.
No, but what I mean is it's in discussion. People are talking about the cap and it's adding an interesting... you know, an interesting angle to everything that's happening. Obviously, coming up, we've got...
an interesting flavour.
Exactly, an interesting flavour, yeah. And obviously, we've got... the fun is actually not over. We've got the strategic plans coming up, the drafts of which are due at the end of this year. And already there's, you know, there's a lot of pressure on this. I mean, I saw even just today, lots of kind of campaigning and criticism coming from Portugal over there. Strategic plan, there was 100 academics and different 14, I think, environmental NGOs that were criticizing the plan. There's already a lot of pressure and a lot of movement on this. I think it's going to be a really interesting topic as we approach the end of this year. So something to watch out for.
Which is why we're moving our focus on, you know, from Brussels to the capitals in our forthcoming coverage of the Common Agricultural Policy implementation. It's true that there's still one step to be done before the formal approval of the new subsidy program for farmers, which is actually scheduled for November, although it might be subject to change.
October,
November. Yeah, it could be... either the plenary in October, if I remember correctly, there are two plenaries, or the one early November. But again, the governments, national governments, are already, and of course the agriculture ministry of the 27 member states, are already in the process of drafting their strategic plans. And as you said, it's already a topic of debate in the public opinion, because of course strategic plan, just to mention one aspect, the member state will put in practice their ambition in moving toward a more sustainable food system, with, for instance, the environmental conditionality. So the eco scheme, they will basically select the eco scheme that they want to put in practice in the strategic plan. The Commission already gave some suggestions. There are in the coming days we will have a new CAP tracker, which will be more focused on the implementation and so on the national strategic plan. So you can have a look or a glimpse at what are the suggestions of the Commission and what will be the practices that the member state will pursue. So yeah, definitely strategic plans is one of the main thing that we're gonna look at in the next months. But what else?
What else? What else is coming up on the menu, you mean?
Yeah.
and what's been interesting? Well, I mean, this has been, I think, a big year, in my opinion, for animal welfare. We've seen so much moving on animal welfare. Most recently, the End the Cage initiative, which was endorsed. So I think that's a really interesting area that I think we're going to see a lot more of. Obviously, there's a lot of things to be worked out here, you know, in terms of support for the farming sector and how you can transition. But this year, we've seen End the Cage. We've seen bans or considerations on live exports of animals. We've seen conversations over, you know, animal welfare standards imposed on imports and to do with trade and animal welfare. And also this ruling we had about stunning before slaughter to do with halal. So I think it's been a big animal welfare year, and I think it will continue to be so into the new year, not the new year, the new school year. And speaking of animal welfare, there was also a development this week. There was a discussion in the Agri-Fish Council over turkey welfare. And this is basically about the idea that there is no there's no EU-wide minimum standards in turkey farming. And this is something that we spoke with Sarah Vina about, Green MEP Sarah Vina, and this is what she had to say.
The turkey is the third most slaughtered animal in the EU. It means we don't speak about 1,000 turkeys or 10,000 turkeys or 1 million. We speak about 190 million of turkeys who were slaughtered every year in the EU. So it's the third slaughtered animal in the EU, and there are not EU standards, minimum standards for turkeys. Can you imagine this? So I think this is a huge problem. Nobody wants to eat these poor animals, and nobody is the lawyer for turkeys, but there is an EU Mindeststandard in Austria. Normally, turkeys, they say 1 square meter, they can have 60 or 70 kilos per square meter, and in Austria, it's they made a level from 40 kilos for a square meter. Mm-hmm. And I would say it's not ideal,
okay,
but it's better than every other country in the EU. And Austria showed that they can survive economically with this standard, and should be the proof that the other countries in Europe could have the same standard. The information note to this initiative wants to see mandatory husbandry requirements for turkey farming based on up-to-date scientific knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
This is very important, because we don't speak about feelings, moral, ethics. I speak about personally. But mm-hmm. in the parliament, we speak about up-to-date scientific knowledge and latest scientific research and experiences. And if we look at this point, we have the evidence, the scientific evidence, that we can change, and we have to change this system. And so it's not about feelings, it's about hard scientific facts.
Since you mentioned the End of Cage initiative, just to flag out the fact that there was a council meeting, EU council meeting, namely a gathering of EU agriculture ministers, and they had a first round of exchanging views. On the End of Cage, it was the first time that the ministers will put forward their, takes, but also their concerns about this initiative, which we remember to our listener, it's basically an European Citizens Initiative. So basically, it came from the EU citizens. They gathered 1.4 million signatures, and they basically, the proponent of this initiative, called for a transition to a cage-free farming system. And recently, the Commission, 2 weeks ago, accepted, but it actually committed to deliver these requests by citizens, and they're gonna present a legislative initiative by the end of 2023. So basically, still in this commission mandate. That's why it's something interesting. At the same time, we basically noticed a bit of difference between, you know, how it was received by the European Parliament and how it was received by the ministers. So basically the two lawmakers that will approve or not the legislative initiative. So the European Parliament, the reception was very positive, while ministers, they agreed on the general ambition, but still they had some concerns, particularly when it comes to, of course, the need of the impact assessment. Again, the Commission is committed to do this impact assessment.
The famous impact assessment.
Yeah, the impact assessment is another.
For everything.
is the words of the school year, because I mean, impact assessment is always the solution. Because, you know. But for instance, they also highlight the need for providing financial incentives, because otherwise the burden of this transition would be on farmers' shoulders only. Again, the Commission recalled that there are some funds, EU funds, in the next common agricultural policy on this, because it's of course animal welfare is considered an environmentally friendly agriculture practice. But for instance, Finland, the Finnish minister Jari Leppä suggested the possibility to have other subsidies other than the common agricultural policy in line with state aid guidelines, which is super interesting, because there will be actually a reform of the current state aid system that we presented in October to be confirmed. And I recall to our listener that the state aid competence is no longer in the hand of DG Agri, but of course state aid in the agricultural sector, but it basically came in the end in the hands of DG Comp. So DG Competition, mm-hmm. Vestager, which is a quite relevant change. And that means that we're going to have a look in October at the new guidelines on state aid, also considering the fact that, I mean, the funds for the transition in the CAP couldn't be enough. So that's why state aid becomes an interesting topic. But yeah, you were saying, Tash, absolutely, you're right. I think that it was the year of animal welfare. That's true. Mm. At the same time, there was also another much awaited, it wasn't a legislative initiative, but a study, which was the one on gene editing.
I was just about to say, as you were talking about impact assessments. And
indeed.
There's the segue straight into it.
How it went, this impact assessment, was well received?
I think it was quite divisive. Well, no, I know it was divisive, very controversial. So there was this study, long-awaited study by the European Commission on new genomic techniques, which concluded that the current legal framework governing these techniques is insufficient, and basically indicated that a new policy instrument should be considered to get the benefits of this technology. So the study didn't question the legal ruling. The legal ruling we're talking about was back in 2018, the ruling that gene-edited organisms or new genomic techniques should, in principle, fall under the GMO directive. So the commission study doesn't question that, doesn't say, you know, doesn't go against the legal ruling, but it does say that, you know, developments in biotechnology, that there's some regulatory uncertainty around this, and basically gives some strong indications that the current legislation is not fit for purpose. So it was controversial, so I think it's safe to say, and paves the way for some very interesting discussions, I would say, on gene editing. And not least because the EU's former members and neighbours, the UK, they are upping their game when it comes to gene editing, shall we say. I mean, it was part of when they moved away from the EU, they were talking about reaping the benefits of biotechnology and new technologies. And just yesterday, I'm recording this on Friday, so just this week, the UK government released this statement about seizing opportunities after Brexit to unleash innovation by overhauling red tape. This is their words. And part of this, they were saying that the UK will move away from the EU's, and this, I'm quoting this as well, the excessive use of the precautionary principle inherited in the UK. And instead, they're going to move towards this proportionality principle in their regulatory framework. So I think that screams to me biotechnology. And I think it's going to be a very, very interesting development and discussion to follow, to see what the UK is doing, to see what impact that will have to do with trade between the two, if they're not on a level playing field when it comes to this, and also to see, you know, on the EU side, what's it going to do in the aftermath of this study on this incredibly controversial topic.
It's actually, it's very interesting what you say, because it's a further evidence that what happened in this year is linked to what will happen in the next one. Again, school year. Yeah. Because, I mean, we're basically having a review of what happened. And we having, for each topic, we're having something happen this week as a reference. Like,
it's true.
The end of Cage, and now the what happened in the UK yesterday. Yeah. So it's interesting and actually quite... It's exciting but also challenging, because it's particularly for us, not us as journalists, but people interested in these topics, to keep track. It really needs a full time coverage, in the sense that you really need to follow up on. Yeah, awesome. But I mean, in general, for incidentally, you need to follow your active, but. It's becoming a bit complicated to follow all this stuff, because you basically miss one thing, and it's like you miss the whole picture, or it becomes more difficult to see the whole picture if you miss one particular
little parts. Yeah, you need all the pieces of the puzzle, which is our job, where we come in, trying to put them all together.
For instance, that's another good example. One thing that we covered quite a lot was actually the impact that the US election would have had on the agri-food sector in Europe. Mm-hmm. And actually, we can say in the end, we were right, because we really see a change of tack in the relation between the US and the EU.
Definitely.
Again, just to mention something happened this week,
yeah.
The agriculture secretary of the Biden's administration had a virtual lunch, of course, with the ministers in the Agri-Fish Council. And last week, I think it was last week or 2 weeks ago, he was basically heard by the member of the European Parliament, the Agriculture Committee, which is something, I mean, we couldn't have imagined something like that for his predecessor, no? Mm. And it was in the air. I mean, we kind of...
Love is in the air.
love between the US and the EU.
Love's a strong word. A thawing of relations, shall we say.
Yeah. And basically trade could also be it has been important in the agri-food agenda, but it could be even more important in the next months, as Natasha was mentioned. There are a lot of debates ongoing on how to avoid the externalization of the current problematic the European Union wants to cope with the farm-to-fork strategy. For instance, emissions. I mean, we're going to ask European farmers to reduce emissions, and they need to avoid, the European Union, the European Commission, want to avoid that these bad practices are externalized. So this could be, and Natasha was mentioning something on animal welfare, no? It's the same. Yeah. How to, this is actually a huge challenge for the future. So ensure that even imported products could have the same very high environmental standard, which is something that already happened like 20 years ago with food safety, when the European Union started to approve very strict food safety rules. And we had the same, basically, we had the same discussion. So how we will be sure that even other will basically meet the high standards on food safety, and we're going to have the same path or the same debates on this when it comes to the environment sustainability.
Definitely.
What else, Tash?
Well, something else has happened this week, believe it or not. Last week, I suppose. You know, we've seen over the last week or so absolute devastation in the agricultural sector and other sectors with the flooding that we've seen in various places, Belgium, Netherlands, Germany, Luxembourg. We've also had fires. Earlier this year, we had that horrific frost. Now there's also warnings of hail coming in France, and also some warnings of potential disruption when it comes to seasonal workers for the harvest coming up after summer. And so I think it's safe to say, I mean, the agri sector has taken a bit of a beating this year, as many sectors have. But in terms of these natural disasters that we're seeing increasingly, you know, the topic, the discussion is going to turn increasingly to resilience and how we can improve the resilience of the sector. And, you know, these situations with these natural disasters, with flooding, with frost, with fires, all these crises, it's just going to get worse and worse, you know, with climate change. So definitely this was a key theme of the Slovenian presidency. I had an interview with the Slovenian agricultural minister who basically said that, you know, crisis resilience and building this resilience against crisis is one of the main priorities of the Slovenian presidency. And this is something that we're going to have to focus on much, much more. And, you know, it's really a reality of now. We're not talking about in the, you know, preparing for future, you know, between these natural disasters and plus obviously COVID, the COVID pandemic. You know, this is really a discussion for now and not for tomorrow. So that's going to be something that I think is going to be a key theme as well coming up.
Yeah, it's true. And also because, I mean, there's a bit of an abuse of the sentence or the combination of words, which is the perfect storm. But yeah, sometime we could actually, I mean, perfect storm also because of the weather condition. But for instance, again, something that was mentioned at the beginning of the week during the Agri-Fish Council this week was the high prices of feed for livestock, basically. This is putting pressure on a sector, which is the livestock sector, already hit by the pandemic, the closure of the Horeca sector, and certain behavior put in place by trade partners like China, the US. For instance, in China, it's not a behavior, but actually there's a current problem with pig meat that is influencing the prices of pig meat at the global level. So these member states are basically experienced, many member states, Spain, Latvia, Croatia, they're experiencing an increase between 25 and 60% in the price, in the market price of the animal feed. And consider that it is estimated that the cost of feed for livestock accounts for up to 80% of the total cost for livestock farmers, and this will particularly affect dairy, the dairy sector. No, so again, these crises are not only not only tragic in the sense that they happen, you cannot really predict. You can imagine that something could happen because of the weather condition, of the worsening of the extreme weather condition. But they have this, unfortunately, they have this capacity to be interlinked and to increase the and create this perfect storm. So that's why it's another thing to keep an eye on. And very briefly, other things that were interesting too.
There's plenty of things. I don't know about this week, but a theme that, I mean, it's your pet theme, Gerardo, that we're definitely going to revisit again after summer, if the hub is still standing. And that's something we've covered very intensively this year on nutritional labeling.
Ah, yeah, labeling in general.
Because or labeling in general. Actually, labeling in general isn't probably
there's
much
a newcomer,
more.
Which is the...
There's several newcomers,
no? Yeah.
Yeah.
Or EcoScore Live.
New kid on the block. Wow.
Yeah.
So much to write about.
Yeah, that there will be a lot to talk about this because I mean we're approaching the showdown, which would be basically the launch of this initiative from the Commission on the new EU-wide labeling scheme. Again, at the moment, we don't know what to expect.
Tensions are high.
Tension, and also I would say that the opponents of the Nutri-Score are actually playing a very good game. It's not that obvious because, for instance, Italians are famous for basically caring of what's happening in the EU when a legislation is already approved. this is what we say normally in Italy. And this
closing
time,
the door after the horse is bolted. Is the phrase that springs to mind.
This time, Italians, but also part of the Spanish food and drink sector, Greece, they're really playing a good lobbying game, let's say. So we'll see what could happen. And also, since we're actually mentioning what's coming next, no? Unless you want to mention something.
Oh, there'll be plenty of other things. Make sure you follow your active for all the for all the extra fun. No, but I think we hit the main.
Yeah.
But where are you going?
What to expect? So first of all, we already mentioned the strategic plans. Very interesting. We didn't mention Brexit. No, we actually mentioned Brexit in the sense of the biotech. But expect something on Brexit too, because I mean, we kind of understood that food is one of the contentious issue between the two. New trade partners.
Very diplomatic.
Yeah, but there are also there's something in the pipeline that it's more specific, like the soil strategy. There will be in December this. Restoration, deforestation, and so, which will be a follow-up of the 54-55 presented last week. And there will be, in this context, the soil strategy, which won't be a legislative initiative, but more a communication from the Commission. But still, it's something
mentioned worthy.
Yeah, definitely. At the same time, in December, again, there will also be a package on the sustainable products and consumption with a proposal for a regulation on basically environmental claims on products. You know, products that use these environmental claims like environmental footprint and so on. This is also interesting. The so-called green claims. I know that actually Natasha covered quite a lot the healthy claim. So it's also the other side of the problem. And then we also have the Carbon Farming Initiative, which is scheduled by the end of the year.
Yes, excited about this one.
Yeah, and of course, starting from January 2022, we're gonna have the entry into force of the new organic regulation. This is another aspect, and I'd say that there's also probably there will be the contingency plan for ensuring food supply and food security, which is something included in the farm to fork to consider the food security issue, particularly in time of crisis, and improving the response of the EU in the agricultural sector when it comes to crisis, and to ensure, of course, the food security.
So not so much a menu so much as an all-you-can-eat buffet.
Yeah, that's a good analogy.
And speaking of the CAP and issues to be resolved on the CAP, so one of the big bones of contention in the CAP reform negotiations was over social conditionality. So that's this idea of tying funds to upholding workers' conditions and workers' rights. And actually, we spoke to also looking to the future of how to monitor this and how to look at this and make sure that farmers are complying with workers' rights, and also really looking in a very futuristic method to do so. We spoke with Professor Doreen Boyd from the University of Nottingham about a project she's been working on in Greece.
There's also a lot of issues in the agricultural sector when it comes to labour exploitation. So I understand that you and your team have been working on the power of satellite technology to try and help tackle this labour exploitation on farms in Greece. So maybe could you explain a little bit, what you did and how this technology helped with this?
We've been really excited by the traction that we've gained in Greece, and I think it's a really good example of how what we call Earth observation data, so satellite data, sort of imagery type data that we will see on Google Earth, and thinking about how that could be used in particular for the agricultural sector beyond Greece. But Greece has been a really good testing ground for us, because we've got the link with the Special Rapporteur for human trafficking, and also with non-governmental organisations on the ground. But essentially, the situation in Greece was there's a small area in Greece that grows strawberries. And, that's absolutely fine, but it's very labour-intensive to pick the strawberries once they're ripe. Now, we know that the last 5 years or so, we've seen a massive influx in migration into Europe. And many of those migrants have settled in Greece, but aren't there officially. And so what that leads to is a sort of situation where exploitation can occur. So migrants have to live somewhere, and they've been living in and around these strawberry farms and the strawberry fields. And they've been living in makeshift accommodation, which are visible to the satellite that are orbiting. So in 2013, there was a particular incident that led to Greece actually being cautioned by the Court of Human Rights in 2017 and told to, up their game in terms of, looking after and protecting the migrants in terms of preventing exploitation. So That obviously is an issue for resources. How do you, in limited resources, in a limited resources world, think, monitor where these migrants might be settling, and then to make sure that they're being looked after as much as possible and not being exploited. So working with the particular NGO, and the Special Rapporteur, we basically said, well, if we can see these structures where migrants are living, then we can tell you exactly where you need to go to make sure that everything is okay. And so that is exactly what we did. We use a satellite imagery, different types of imagery which have different characteristics, to produce a map of where the migrants were settled. And it's much easier to do that from above than it is from, say, a road, because often migrants are living in areas that are hidden. They don't want to be seen because they might not have these, you know, the official papers and so on. So what that allowed us to do is then tell the NGOs where to go in order to ask questions around migrant welfare and their working conditions as well as their living condition. And that was all fed into what we call a multi-criteria decision analysis. And that model, resultant model, helps NGOs, governments and other organisations to prioritise where they might want to visit in terms of a depleted resource environment, but being able to target exactly who might benefit more from having some help or intervention. And it's a way of showing then that a particular government or particular state governance is actually doing all they can in order to meet the ILO conventions or the European Union laws around human rights.
So you focus more on this aspect of the migrant exploitation. But I want to ask if you think that this technology can also be, easily transferred to other situations or to other kinds of agriculture situation, of course.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So, the use of satellite technology within the agricultural sector is something that has been going on for many years now. And in fact, it was the agricultural sector really that took up the sort of operationalization and commercialization of using such technology. So it's often used to predict the crop yield for a farmer, or to tell the farmer which part of their fields or their land is suffering from, say, drought or nutrient depletion. So that kind of thing, in terms of maximising the yield for a farmer, then this sort of technology has been used a lot. In terms of the sort of humanitarian side of things within agriculture, I think this is the first time that we've seen that kind of meeting of minds and the consideration of where this might go in the future.
Yeah, and we're always talking about this kind of cross collaboration, you know, cross-sectoral collaboration. So it's really interesting to bring these together. And I know you mentioned briefly, you know, some of the benefits, things like you can't necessarily see what's going on from the road, but you can from above. But I'm wondering what other benefits this kind of monitoring, the satellite monitoring, could have compared to normal ways of kind of verifying labour exploitation on farms on the ground. Presumably it involves, you know, in-person visits. For example, I'm kind of wondering, you know, what are the costs associated with this technology? Many of the countries where we see a lot of labour exploitation are countries that maybe are not economically super strong. So I'm wondering kind of what costs are involved and what the benefits are of using this kind of technology.
There are many sort of advantages of using Earth observation. One of which is that sort of monitoring ability. So, you know, there are Earth observation satellites that will give you daily imaging of a particular area if that's what you wanted, but you'd have to pay for that particular technology. Whereas if you didn't need daily, but you needed, say, weekly monitoring, then actually there's satellites that are orbiting that you can download the imagery for free. And so the European Union, well, the European Space Agency have been a very big advocate of that. So open source data. So what that then leads you to is nil cost in terms of data, but then obviously you need some sort of technical expertise there to be able to extract the intelligence that you need from that data. But in fact, once you've trained an algorithm or computational model what to look for, then that sort of thing can be automated, and then you have a work stream that is operating in the background. And more countries now will have some sort of space agency or environmental agency that will have experts in Earth observation. And so I think what we need to start thinking about is actually not Earth observation just for sort of environmental applications, which is what it had tended to be, but think about what Earth observation can do on the humanitarian, in particular the modern slavery, labour exploitation side of things. And that's what we're really keen to shout about and to get organisations thinking about, that those people who have been trained up to look at, you know, loss of trees from space could easily then transfer that knowledge to a particular situation that's akin to modern slavery or labour exploitation, and in this case within the agricultural sector.
And one of the most contentious part of the common agricultural policy, so the EU's farming subsidies program, is the introduction of this concept, which is the social conditionality. So basically, the disbursement of the funds will depend on the respect of certain labor rights, actually the basic labor rights. But there were a large part of the objections from member states, which was basically over the cost and the energy, you know, the efforts in the farm checks and visits. So do you think that this, you know, the use of this satellite and also this technology, like you did in this way, could help with ensuring farmers complying with worker rights as set out in this reform of the common agricultural policy?
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. I think there are several things that need to be considered here. In the Neo Manilada example, we knew that the workers, the migrants, were living in particular structures, and basically what they were using was the those sort of greenhouses, you know, the plastic greenhouses. They were taking those from the fields and they were making makeshift camps with those. So if you have that kind of situation again, where there is a, if you like, a physical indicator of where people are, then what you're doing is literally mapping and counting where those physical structures are, and then using that to get one an idea of how many people are in a particular area. And then if you cross refer that to the crop yield in an area, then you start to get a picture of what's going on. You know, how can this crop yield be produced if you've only got these number of people? You know, X and Y equals Z, that kind of thing. And then, of course, what's really important is to have that ground element as well, or the ground segment. So you would need a local partner, or even a local government to then go visit particular sites that you've mapped to get that, what we call sort of ground truthing, an idea that, okay, what we can see on the satellite image equals this, and that this is what we can see on the ground. And then you start to build a picture up of what's going on the ground. And then that can lead you then to looking for more things in the imagery. Because, of course, the Earth observation data, the imagery data, it's just a load of numbers. So you need that sort of ground intelligence to understand what those numbers actually mean. And then the next step is, with the ground intelligence, what that means then for trying to prevent any labour exploitation, or, you know, obviously in the first place to sort of give you a risk score. This particular site may well be somewhere to go visit to understand what's going on. So absolutely, there's that transferability from what we've done in Greece to other member states. It's just getting that idea of what we need to look for in the imagery. Once you've got that, then the rest of it's pretty straightforward, because the satellite data we have now is really rich in terms of what you can see. I'm sure everyone's looked at their, you know, where they live on Google Earth. It's that kind of resolution of data that we were using for this particular study.
That's great. Thank you so much. It's absolutely fascinating to hear, how this kind of technology is being used. It's really, really quite incredible.
So that's all from us this week. And this week, like every week, the Euractiv AgriFood podcast was produced by Euractiv's AgriFood news team. That's Gerardo Fortuna and Natasha Foote, with the technical support of our podcast producer, Evie Chiori. And you can also find this podcast on all major streaming platforms. That's Amazon, Apple, Spotify and Stitcher.
Be sure to subscribe to our newsletter so you don't miss the latest agriculture news from the EU. I'm Gerardo Fortuna. Thanks for listening and have a great summer break.